This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com. and on Instagram and Twitter at Burned by Books. Let's start the show. When the narrator of Marie Mutsky-Mockett's newest novel, The Tree Doctor, is separated from her Hong Kong-based family in California by the beginning of the COVID virus pandemic, she finds herself alone in her family home, tending the trees and plants of her mother's recently abandoned garden. When she reaches out to an arborist for advice and assistance with injured and dying trees, the eponymous tree doctor comes into her life with hands knotted and gnarled like a tree's trunk. What begins as an arboreal relationship blossoms quickly into an intense sexual affair in which the narrator feels suddenly intensely alive in her body. As the connection evolves and becomes increasingly more intimate and sexually passionate, the narrator experiences the distance and loss of being separated from her children and her mother, whose dementia makes their screen-mediated conversations vexing and worrying. Questioning her role as mother and wife and the nature of her newly fiery affair builds to a literal and figurative conflagration, with wildfires ravaging the areas around her home. Bracketing this pandemic-era affair are the narrator's experiences teaching a thousand-year-old proto-novel, Murasaki Shikibu's The Tale of Genji, a Heian-era court novel that makes for messy conversations about sex, desire, consent, power, and gender. A transcultural novel that nevertheless indulges in the local beauty of California's uniquely fecund ecological zone, The Tree Doctor both recalls the specificity of our still uncertain relationship to the COVID virus, while calling on historical analogies to plagues and fires of the distant past, to try and understand whether and how female power and sexual identity can exist in societies that fear and demonize it. Marie's the author of a previous novel, Picking Bones from Ash, and two books of nonfiction, American Harvest, which won the Nebraska Book Award, and the Northern California Book Award, and Where the Dead Pause and the Japanese Say Goodbye, which was a finalist for the Penn Open Book Award. A graduate of Columbia University in East Asian Studies, she has been awarded NEA, JUSFC, and Fulbright Fellowships, both for Japan. Welcome to Burned by Books, Marie.
Thank you. My goodness, what an introduction. Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I would say The Tree Doctor is joining a growing number, but still only a handful of what I would call true pandemic books. I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about your decision to set the novel during the worst months and years of the pandemic, and also talk a little bit about how your own experience of the pandemic, whether you were writing it during the worst of it or afterwards, shaped the book.
Well, I was writing it during the worst of the pandemic. I really wrote it, I think the first lines were written in May of 2020. And by then we had all been home for maybe 2 months. I had a book come out in April of 2020, and all of the exciting things that were planned for that book, you know, kind of evaporated because of the pandemic. And for some reason, at the same time, I suddenly had this idea for a novel and thought, well, that would be a good way to get through the disappointment of, you know, not being able to go out into the world with this other book. And I had just done a virtual event, I think, with my friend Al Heathcock, the novelist. And I said, hey, you know, I have this idea for a novel. And he said, well, you know, you should just write a little bit every day and see what happens. And so I did. But I think in terms of why I said it in the worst of the pandemic, my mother was from Japan, and we went to Japan together a lot. I grew up in the United States, and we saw a lot of family, but I was also very lucky. She took me to see some of the areas that are of cultural significance in Japan. And very often these temples and shrines were connected to past plagues. And there was a period of time where I was annoyed. I know I'd have to go to another temple with another medicine Buddha and pray to the medicine Buddha. And my mother became critically ill when I was 10 and was plagued with health problems for most of my life and most of the years that we had together. So whenever we would go to one of these temples, we were just going because it was historic or cultural or important. But also we would offer a prayer that her illnesses would be cured. And so I grew up with an awareness of, I think, of illness. And over time, it started to dawn on me that these plagues, these massive break, these illnesses that would break out, were a part of history, but it also could come and affect us today. You know, in leading up to COVID-19, you heard about mad cow disease or swine flu or different bird flus, variations of bird flu. And I always wondered, you know, what would happen if one of those illnesses came to the United States? And I guess I started paying attention to COVID in the news, probably even as early as December. And by February, I thought, oh, this is it. One of those events. But I understood it in the context of past plagues. I think in the United States, we would talk about the Spanish flu and we talked about the Black Plague. You know, the Black Plague being very, very old and the Spanish flu being much more recent. But those were kind of our historical markers. But I related it to all of these things that had happened in Japan and these places that I had been to with my mom. So I felt like I took it seriously. But knowing that it was a sort of historical event, even though there was a great deal of unknown, we didn't know when it was going to end, I did sort of think, well, it will at some point come to an end.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So you see some of that within the writing of The Tree Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the having a historical analogy for the what appears to be a fairly regularized once a century or so pandemic, you know, I would imagine does give one a sense of perspective that it's not eternal. And I guess
That's what I told myself anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're still waiting it out, but
absolutely.
I'm hopeful too that it will be another historical marker that maybe someone else will find some comfort in. The initial conflict of the novel is that the narrator is separated from her husband and children by the pandemic lockdowns and travel restrictions. But that distance puts the real border between them and turns it into a kind of intangible distance that in many ways is a breaking of a taboo about the way that women are supposed to show maternal instincts for their families.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about breaking this unwritten rule, although more and more less unwritten and more talked about, but long understood way that women are supposed to have connections to their families and what it was like to write a character who at least for a period of time, wants to live with that distance.
It's interesting. I think in the very first draft, or the very first draft that I showed anybody, I had a female reader, and she was very concerned about the fact that the protagonist isn't trying harder to think about her children or talk to her children or get back to her children. And then subsequent readers said, well, no, that's okay. She just isn't trying to get back to her children. I think that there's an element of fantasy. I hesitate to use that word, but there's an element of fantasy to the things that happen in the story, right? In terms mm-hmm. of her relationship with the tree doctor, in terms of her willingness to be separated from her children. I think that most people I know who have kids, are very devoted to their children, but there's certainly times where they might say, oh, I'm so glad to have an hour to myself, or, you know, the baby's asleep. I've got 30 minutes. Do I take a nap or do I get something done? What do I do? You know, this is like something that I was always facing. Certainly when I had a very small child, I think the advice is to take a nap. And then I would think, but I have this, you know, like this half hour of autonomy. I could get something done. So I was very aware of those questions that parents have and that women have, and then I amplified them for this novel. And I could certainly see how the lockdown, on the one hand, the lockdown caused a lot of chaos, certainly ways in which we were, as a society, accustomed to functioning, many of those systems broke down. And I thought, well, what if you have someone who sees this as an opportunity, mm-hmm. who isn't plagued by how do I get it all back to normal, or oh, I'm waking up again and I can't get my life back to normal. When is it going to be normal? I need everything to go back to the way that it was. What if we have somebody who's thinking, okay, well, all right, so how do I make this work for myself? You know? And so she does for a little while.
It's not that she's unvexed or untortured in some ways by her own relationship to that distance and to how she desires it, but also, you know, feels external and internal guilt about it.
Yes. No, but, I was going to say something that I haven't talked about in any interview or to anybody is the fact that when my son and I were staying in my childhood home in California during the pandemic. And across the street from us was a family from China originally. And both sets of grandparents, I think, were in that house. So it was a family of four, the mother, father, the two children, and then two sets of grandparents. So it's eight people in a house. And every day I would see the grandparents out walking up and down the street, and they couldn't speak any English. And every now and then I would hear Chinese opera booming from the house across the street. Yeah. And I would stop and talk to the mother and the father. And they told me how difficult it was for their parents to go back. So we can't get a ticket to go back. And then when we can get a ticket, it's extremely expensive, like $10,000. So there was a period of time where return was difficult. And so I amplified it to make it very difficult for her to go back. I mean, I remember reading stories about people who were traveling around the world, even though the world was on lockdown. I remember seeing a couple of those stories. And of course, that's one way in which a person might look at this breakdown of all of the societal norms and think, okay, you know, how do I make this work for me? Travel, I think, in general was very difficult. And so I thought, well, this could be something that could happen. A parent could be trapped and unable to get back to their family easily, particularly if the country they were trying to return to was China.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Having it be Chinese Hong Kong. I mean, that travel restriction lasted a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And you describe the really the kind of torturous process of quarantining, where you have to like be in a quarantine hotel, that is only if you manage a negative test.
That's right.
If you test positive while you're in the quarantine hotel, then God knows what's going to happen next.
I had friends who were traveling back to Japan later on in the pandemic, and they said they had to quarantine, and then they would get a phone call every day from somebody in the, I don't know, in the health department in Japan, and that they had to be in the same location because the whoever was calling them would check to make sure that they were actually in their hotel or in their same place where they were quarantined before they were allowed to go out. So you couldn't go, this is just Japan. You couldn't go back to Japan and then, you know, say, okay, I'm here. I'm quarantining in my hotel. You can trust me. You know, it didn't work like that.
You had to be by the phone, I guess.
Yeah. And so I think, and it was unexpected when the checkup call was going to come. So you couldn't even necessarily go out for a walk because somebody might Zoom call you and then discover that you weren't where you were supposed to be. And so I imagine the process in China was even more intense.
Oh, yeah. And they had the sort of sentry robots sort of patrolling the streets, telling you to stay inside.
Yeah.
And I had friends in Spain who you had to have for a while, you had to have a police escort to go to the grocery store.
Wow.
And whenever I hear about Americans sort of complaining that all their freedoms were taken away
during
the pandemic, I think about China, Japan, most of Europe, and it seems a little laughable. But
yeah, it was uncomfortable for Americans for sure.
The object of the narrator's desire, the tree doctor, comes to her home initially to deal with the care of trees and flowers that her mother has had to abandon going into a nursing home. And the grafting and care for the trees and plants will become one of the leitmotifs of the novel. I wonder how you became initially interested in arborists and the relationship between the broader relationship between humans and trees.
It's funny. I've been trying to recall the exact moment where the idea of the tree came to me. I was, as I mentioned, staying in my childhood home in California with my son. And then my husband came down from San Francisco a couple of months later with the cats. But I pretty quickly turned my attention to gardening because I thought, okay, the ways in which I was occupying my time are gone for a while. And I do know how to take care of a garden. So I'll take care of a garden. My mother had been taking care of the garden and she was not well. And so the garden needed a lot of care. And certainly trees needed a lot of care. And I don't know how I happened upon the cherry tree in particular. I mean, I think once I started to think about the tale of Genji and I started to think about Japanese culture, the sakura tree, the cherry tree, is certainly an important symbol. Really, all trees in Japan, I guess, are very carefully cared for. And somehow this idea that there might be a tree that was having some difficulty and some stress and needed to be brought back. I don't know exactly how that occurred to me as a metaphor for other things that were going on in the story, but it all sort of seemed to connect together. And it was interesting. I thought about this actually before I had gone back to the tale of Genji, but subsequent to kind of coming up with the tree doctor and coming up with this cherry tree that I call Einstein within the book. Mm-hmm. Although Einstein does come from something specific, which I can share with you. I did discover that there were all of these tree-related moments in the tale of Genji and that there were synchronicities I hadn't expected. So that was kind of exciting.
I bet. I'm particularly interested in the kind of attention and care that is required for trees to thrive and how that operates in opposition to the way in which the narrator feels the lack of care given to her, even by her own self, even as she must care for others. Could you discuss
this? I think that's something that happens to a lot of people as they get older and as they're part of what's called the sandwich generation, where they're sandwiched between caring for younger people, for children who need a lot of intense focus and a lot of care and attention and nurturing. And then, people who are in their 40s and 50s, perhaps even younger, who are caring for small children who have needs. And then parents who are aging, who are not so well, who also need a similar sort of care and attention. A person's attention can be very divided if they're trying to do both at the same time. And so the self-care, or what we call self-care, becomes very difficult and is not a priority. I kind of think societally, we expect people in middle age to just accept that role, to be fine.
Yeah, yeah,
very much. Denial of self and denial of one's physical needs is just the way that it is, and it's okay. I think that's true for men and for women. You were young, you had your fun, and now you got to take care of it. And that's okay, because you've grown up, you've grown out of the desire to be attractive, to have that surge of adrenaline, or any of the sort of the chemical reactions that come from being attracted to somebody or being really excited about somebody. You're really excited in their presence or just talking with them. That certain kind of aliveness that disappears. I think the fact is that most people have that capacity within them. And there are certainly people who are older than middle age who have that capacity within them, and that can be activated at any point.
Well, that raises for me the question of the narrator's mother, who, due to her suffering from dementia, and at least at the beginning of the novel, they're only being able to communicate through this sort of mediated a nurse or a nurse's aide helping to have that conversation. There's this sense of a failure of translation that then is mapped onto the fact that the narrator sees her mother's kind of life as one of total lack of desire, even though this turns out not to be true.
Right.
And she does not want that to be a model that she takes on. And yet what we learn is that her mother has a much more complicated life of desire and needs than was understood.
Yeah.
And so here's this woman in the twilight of her life, who seems to be this one thing and then is discovered to be something else. And I wonder how you think of how this relationship between the narrator and her mother then kind of offers another window into what this all means.
Well, I think the simplest understanding of that tension is when you are alive, enjoy being alive. I think that that's sort of what the mother is saying. I have this tremendous unlived life. Actually, my unlived life is even greater than you knew, I think, is kind of what, in the most simplistic sense, what the mother is saying to the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And the daughter's thinking, oh, I had really better live my life and be alive and struggle to be alive with all that I have. And then that feeling is amplified against the backdrop of pandemic, where the virus is going around snatching up people's lives.
Absolutely.
And there's also this question of what does it mean to be alive? I guess there are people who spend all day long in a Lothario state. But is that really being alive? There are many ways.
It must be exhausting.
It's a special person. Somehow I think that so many of these crises hit at this point in the protagonist's life, and she has this opportunity to be alone suddenly, and this is what she makes of her time. It's this exploration of, I think of it as an exploration of how close can she get to some life force as a tether through this period. And her mother's life is draining away. And so, all the bullshit is gone because they're running out of time. And so if you're running out of time and there's no time for bullshit and little social structures have all been removed, and what is it we're really looking at and what is it we're really talking about?
And what seems at first her own, the affair that she's having with the tree doctor, what seems like a romantic affair.
Right.
I think reveals itself to be much more of an exploration of herself rather than this relationship between her and this man, who is more and less than what he seems.
Yeah, and, I think so.
And so your reference to like a search for a kind of energy or vitality, what the narrator calls a desire to feel being alive in the body, to wake up in her body. And that's a big difference, I think. Can you talk about the difference between like a romance affair and this kind of coming to an understanding of oneself as having a body?
Yeah, I think society, this, the awareness of the awareness of the body and the awareness of being alive, I think that is one of the things that make sex and the power of sex so tricky to talk about and to define, and to only talk about in terms of legislation, or to only talk about in terms of laws or rules. You know, what I mean is, you can only have sex if you're married. You know, that's one way to live. People flout that all the time. Why do they flout that all the time? Well, there are a lot of reasons that are given, one of which is that people seek intimacy and sex is a form of intimacy, and they want to feel a sort of nurture and care from somebody else, that they're being seen, and they want to have a connection to somebody else. So that's, you know, sex about that, that is about intimacy. Then there's also people who abuse sexual power, right? And gain a sense of power over somebody else who's powerless. But I think in this affair that she's having, she's accessing sex as some sort of power for herself. And that really has nothing to do with intimacy. And it also, this is not a relationship where there's a very clear abuse of power either. And I guess I was thinking about some older religions where we talk about the libido or the life force, which is placed front and center as something sacred. What is that? Why is that so powerful? And when religion, take sex out of religion, like organized religion comes along, the Judeo-Christian tradition comes along and tries to impose rules on sex. Why was it doing that? What was everybody afraid of? Well, I think they were afraid because sex is, in fact, very powerful and very motivating. And there are plenty of stories in the news. We can see that around us today, how motivating and how powerful sex is. People can be driven by it and renewed by it and replenished by it. So it's a really complex and tricky topic. And it's a topic that I think is difficult, as I was trying to say in the beginning of my response to your question, that's, you can't just apply a bunch of rules. You can't legislate. You can't say a healthy way to live is to only have sex within the marriage and all other forms of sex are harmful, or all other forms of sex are an abuse of power. Well, it's, you know, much more tricky than shame.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, well, you've begun to unpack a very long and complicated understanding of human sexuality. That allows me to transition into the text, the great intertext of the novel, the Heian era Tale of Genji, often considered the first ever novel. It just so happens that I took a very similar class to the one the narrator teaches, in which we focused just on that book for a period of time and discussed it in great historical and literary details. So I was overjoyed to get to re-experience it, although the students are their own special kind of gift in your novel. Mm-hmm. I wondered why this became your key intertext, and what's your relationship to Murasaki Shikibu's great proto-novel?
Well, it's changed over time. I was thinking about this actually before you and I started speaking. Someone asked me recently when I first read The Tale of Genji, and I think I must have read portions of it when I was in college. But my first interaction with it would have been, I was going to say, was when I was 14 and my mother took me to Kyoto and said, hey, you know, the world's first novel is called The Tale of Genji. It was mostly set here and it was written by a woman. And that really flew in my mind. I was delighted to know that what, you know, you called it a proto novel. Some people call it the first psychological novel, or, you know, other people get into arguments of who actually wrote the first novel and if The Tale of Genji is the first novel. But I mean, it is a great work of narrative fiction, right? And it was written by a woman. And so that was always very sort of inspiring to me. And I always held that in the back of my head. But if I think back when I was, I don't know, 4 or 5, once I started to have clear memories, we would get these packages from Japan We were living in California, and my Japanese grandparents would send packages, food packages, to my mother. It was difficult to get Japanese groceries in those days, certainly where we lived. And very often there was a little packet of candy, Japanese style candies. And on the candy box were figures from the Tale of Genji, because it's a decorative.
Oh, wow.
And so my earliest encounters with Genji were this sort of beautiful Heian era inspired women with long hair and these gorgeous robes that kind of gave me this alternate sense of what beauty could be. And so that's probably the very first way that I encountered that world. And you run into this motif all the time in art, in painting, in Japan. And so I would see it all the time. And it's sort of like, I think, in our American culture, where you don't necessarily have to be Judeo-Christian, but you're actually very familiar with the iconography and the meaning and the duality of good and evil and heaven and hell and angels and devils. And you one is very familiar with this sort of very dual way of looking at the world. I always say to people, you know, you run into kind of Christian reasoning in advertising. Sometimes when we talk about food, for example, you know, the devil on your shoulder says, you know, go eat the chocolate cake, or you've been good today, you know, go ahead, you deserve the chocolate cake, straight out of like Christian reason, I think. I don't really ever see that sort of language in food advertisements in Japan. There's no Christian, Judeo-Christian underpinning our culture. So I think there's a whole set of aesthetics that comes out of the Tale of Genji that's super influential in Japan, in which I felt, but I didn't really know what it was for a very, very long time. And so, you know, I've read and reread the text. And then for this novel, I had to refamiliarize myself with it. I knew that what the scholars say, like if you quickly Google, what is the meaning of the Tale of Genji? There'll be a short answer about being aware of the passage of time, mono no aware, you know, the fragility of things, impermanent. That's kind of the quick Google answer that you'll get. And so, you know, I knew what that meant, essentially. I knew that it had to do with nature. I knew that it had to do with appreciating cherry blossoms and the aging process. And so in a shallow way, I kind of understood those aesthetics. And that fit in with a woman caring for the garden and worrying about the fact that her mother was dying, and seeing her mother dying and worrying about herself one day dying without having fully expressed being alive. So all of that worked really well together. I mean, I could see, that's a whole system of aesthetics that's going to work well together. But then to give the book any meaning, I had to go and really re-engage more deeply with the text. And so then that becomes problematic. Because one realizes that Genji is, you know, not such a great guy, and these women live really difficult lives.
An anti-hero, really.
Yeah, right. And so then what does that all mean, you know? So that's sort of a long-winded answer to your question, but...
Well, one of the things I thought about, and I didn't know if it was on your mind, is I remember learning about how Heian-era court kimonos were so heavy that women could really only sort of do this very interesting sort of basically a like butt scooch across the room when they were wearing the full set of kimonos.
Yes,
and
that
there's
right.
There's even a very old Japanese verb for making that motion across the room. And this sort of sense of being really stuck, like physically stuck, then matched nicely with the idea of how women, you know, were treated in that moment. And even, you know, highly privileged court women were still stuck in a system that was, you know, at best did not favor them, and at worst just misogynistic. And I thought how much that kind of had this nice overlay with being stuck during COVID and trying to kind of move through the intangible webs of misogyny.
I guess I didn't really think about that because I was so aware of the fact that women in the Heian period were at least writing and expressing themselves. And it was a period. I mean, Lady Murasaki is not the only writer during that period, and there are writers before her too. So I tended not to focus on the position of women during the Heian era. And I guess I always was more focused on their accomplishments
I mean, certainly extraordinary accomplishments from the court level, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. No, you had to. It was totally different if you were a peasant, but it would have been if you were a man too.
Sure. You know? No, of course.
Yeah.
I wonder if you found it challenging to relay the plot and characters of such a long novel without having it absolutely just dominate the tree doctor, because you could.
Absolutely. And in fact, I would say that the amount of Tale of Genji that does appear in the Tree Doctor was a later addition. My editor read an earlier draft and said, well, I'd really like to have even more of the Tale of Genji. And I said, really? You know, it's really long and really complex. No, I think there needs to be more. So I put in more. But then I had to cherry pick kind of what to talk about and which scenes were important. Which events were important and which were relevant. And, you know, I could go back to the Tale of Genji in a couple of years and read it again, and I'm sure that other themes would emerge. And that's just how rich that source material is.
But I think you're perfectly on point, at least as far as I'm concerned, in the teaching scenes with how the students want to grapple with sex, desire, consent.
They're completely legitimate questions too. It's really hard for a modern person who's accustomed to freedom and placing their need, you know, understanding that they need to place their needs front and center. Particularly, I think people who are younger than I am are very clear that that's the way they want to live their lives, and that's not what happens in the world of the Tale of Genji. So it's really difficult to read, I think.
Yeah, and I think all young people really are presentist in the way they read things, and so they want it to operate in a logic that they can make sense of in the mores of their moment. But when you have such a big, you know, a millennia of cultural and historical and linguistic difference, and it seems like the narrator's trying to get them to both see, yes, there we can read Genji as you know, violent towards women, as assaulting and certainly violating rules of consent right and left, and then also try and understand that there's a vast gap of historical time and that needs to be reckoned with in some way.
There's that. There's also, I was trying really not to be really heavy-handed with it, but the Tale of Genji gets written. One of the reasons why it's still so cherished is that it conveys Japanese aesthetics and sensibilities that come from the classical period that are still inspiring to people in Japan now. And we would call some of those sensibilities, we would call them Shinto in origin. Not state-sponsored Shinto, but an older form of Shinto, which is basically nature worship, life force worship, and, you know, also an acknowledgement of the power of human sexuality. And there is a scene where Genji, the anti-hero, has a sexual relationship with someone who he's not supposed to have a sexual relationship with. But one of the gods, it's kind of clear from the text, rewards him for this. It's a violation, what Genji does. And the god rewards him for this. And I thought, oh, this is a really ancient example of how powerful sex is and how potentially upsetting it is, but acknowledging that because it is so powerful, you can't just simply contain it or shut it off or turn it away. And that kind of changed my reading of the Tale of Genji. But that very question, you know, what do we do if human sexuality has that power over us? How do we, you know, what are we supposed to do about it? Also, at a deeper level, I think relates to some of what I was trying to get at with the Tree Doctor. But if you also read it that way, then I think going back to the Tale of Genji could potentially be more interesting to see how people navigate this force in their lives. You know, this is a world that doesn't have Christianity in it, doesn't have Judaism in it, it just has Shinto in it. the sort of traditional Japanese aesthetic. So then how do people bob and weave around the incredible force that is exerted over their lives? And you throw on the fact that Genji is the shining prince, right? He's like a combination of Justin Bieber and Elvis and David Beckham or something. And the women have different responses. There are women who manage to evade him completely, and there are women who succumb, and then there are women who are chosen by him, and then there are women who die. And one of the things, this is also contained in the Tree Doctor, but very often scholars will say, I would run into the scholarship that would say, well, we don't really know if Lady Murasaki finished the tale of Genji. The ending sort of trails off. But I read the ending and I thought, oh no, the ending is kind of perfect because there's this woman who has a reaction or response to this ongoing pressure of, you know, what do I do about sex and what do I do about men? And her response is different than everybody else's. And I thought, oh no, I think the tale of Genji intentionally ends the way that it does. That I thought was kind of beautiful.
You mention and bring up the one of the characters that for so many scholars and readers is so important, and that is the Rokujo lady, who is scorned and becomes a ghost who haunts Genji and haunts and kills some of his paramours.
Right,
and she is she's very powerful, wronged and violently vindictive, and she's such an interesting character to have such a prominent role in this historical period. And I wonder how she reflected for you on what was going on in the present day of the Tree Doctor.
You know, the interesting thing about Lady Rokujo is I think I first ran into Rokujo in a literature class that I took in college, and they really only tell you about the meeting at the Hollyhock Festival where Lady Rokujo's angry spirit projects into Lady Aoi, and Lady Aoi later dies. But if you look at the tale of Genji, this happens a couple times. There are other people who die because of Lady Rokujo. And at the end of the tale of Genji, there's the last heroine, Royal Tyler, whose essays on Genji I love so much, suspects that it's Rokujo's presence that also makes the last heroine temporarily ill too. And so her spirit, Lady Rokujo's angry spirit, pervades this novel. But she's not treated as a cartoon character. You know, if you go watch, I can't really say that I've ever watched any of the recent retellings of Snow White, but there's a sort of cartoonishness, Cruella de Vil and, you know, the evil queen and Snow White. They're just evil. They must be vanquished. And that's not how Lady Murasaki treats Lady Rokujo.
No, no.
It's far more complicated than that. It's kind of like, well, of course she's jealous. And later in the tale of Genji, Lady Rokujo and Genji kind of reconcile and are sort of sad. And Rokujo asks Genji, look, will you take care of my daughter, but just please don't sleep with her. I remember meeting Debbie Reynolds, who said to Warren Beatty, okay, you're going to make shampoo with my daughter, Carrie Fisher, but just please don't sleep with her. I thought, oh, it's kind of like Lady Rokujo saying to Genji, look
that
after my daughter, just please don't sleep with her. But it's a really like a human moment that we get from Rokujo, who's saying, you know, what you do is terrible to women. Don't do it to my daughter. And they're sad about the end of their affair. And then she leaves him her estate. He has this amazing estate, right, where he has four different quarters in his estate. Each one's devoted to a different season. And he inherits that from her. So it's a very rich portrayal of what it means to be a woman who's powerful and who has power and can direct power, and the toll that that might take on the woman. But also Genji's awareness of her power. It's really, the whole thing is super complex, but also I think ultimately very human, you know? There's no evil that's like vanquished and then that's the end of the story.
No, no. And that's such a nice way to put it. The novel ends with double disasters, with the pandemic still raging and wildfires destroying the very kind of ecological world that you have so carefully and beautifully described in the novel. The fires are deadly and frightening, but they also act as a metaphorical revelation for the narrator, who understands the nature of her desire and her connection to her family more clearly after the fires.
Right.
How do you see those fires operating in the novel?
Well, I mean, I think you did a really nice job of summarizing it there. You know, there are the raw forces of nature are raw forces of nature and are sort of unstoppable. She sees that and then, but also takes into stock, wait a second, what is the thing that is most precious to me? She realizes her children have been really suffering without her presence.
Mostly because her husband keeps making them watch military documentaries.
Right. Yeah, that's his coping mechanism. So he's trying to get them to do the same thing. But in very small ways, she's changed without giving away the everything that happens in the novel. She's changed as a result of her experiences and is able to be the person who actively reunites the family. And I think I was trying to say, her life changes not as the result of winning $1 million and suddenly being able to, you know, buy a yacht and set sail on the ocean for the next decade. She just makes a couple of small decisions that then change the way their lives are going to be. And I think the novel is trying to suggest that humans can have the capacity for those small changes, that they're internal, and that they can have large ramifications. It was important to me that if I suggested that change happens or can happen, that it's not necessarily tied to somebody having a ton of money. Her changes are not huge, but they're very meaningful, important for her and important for her family.
That's nicely said. Before I let you go, I'd love to know what you've been reading recently and whether you have any recommendations for our listeners.
I mentioned the essays by Royal Tyler, who is a translator and a scholar of Japanese. I think if people would like to know a little bit more about The Tale of Genji, the essays on The Tale of Genji by Royal Tyler are excellent.
Okay.
And accessible too. I'm very excited about Emily Rabiteau's Mothering Against the Apocalypse, what it is to mother during the Anthropocene. And then two books that I really love, one called Border by Kapka Kasababa. It's one of my favorite books I think I've read in the last 5 years. And finally, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, I think it's Martin Puckner, wrote a book Culture, mm-hmm. which I think is just wonderful. So those would be my four recommendations.
Yeah, he's a Harvard professor who writes just about everything. And so when I saw that he was writing about basically a entire world history of culture, I thought that sounded about right for him.
It's a question I have right now. What is culture when we're trying to preserve it? What does that mean? What are we trying to preserve? Are cultures different? I mean, of course they are. Why? And he has a wonderful framework. And I think, you know, there are a lot of conflicts in the world right now. And we talk about land and resources as being sources of cultural of conflict. But I think culture is also part of these conflicts. And so then taking a step back and asking, well, what does that even mean is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I all of these sound great. And I'm going to seek them out. But I want to really recommend The Tree Doctor, which, whether or not you know The Tale of Genji, you will fall in love with the novel for many reasons, for its beautiful descriptions of the wildlife flora of California, for its exploration of desire, sexuality, family, and gender, and for just its beautiful storytelling. So I hope folks will run out and get The Tree Doctor, which will be published this Tuesday, I believe.
Yep. I guess that's tomorrow, but after we're recording on a Monday. So
That is very exciting, and congratulations. And thank you so much for coming on the show to talk with me about it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for your wonderful questions and your interest and your time.
Well, that's all for me for now. My thanks to Marie Mutsky-Mockett for coming on to talk about her latest novel, The Tree Doctor. You can find links to purchase The Tree Doctor and all of Marie's recommended books at the website, burnedbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.